On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
No sane lawyer looks forward to presenting an argument to a jury that the police framed his client. No sane lawyer looks forward to doing that. You know, the police, many people outside of large cities at least, are raised to believe are the good guys. So when you confront the need to present a defense that your client was framed, and worse yet, framed by law enforcement officers, you're not happy.
That's one of the breakout stars of the Netflix true crime series, Making a Murderer. Defense attorney Dean Strang has inspired a fashion Tumblr called Strangcore. Twitter is calling for some Dean Strang fan fiction. The hunger for glossy true crime entertainment has exploded since the podcast Serial aired. We'll talk about the journalistic implications later on in the show. But first, the federal government issued its latest set of nutritional guidelines today. Turns out eggs are okay, along with other foods that are high in cholesterol. And if you are a coffee drinker, you'll be pleased to know that you can have up to 5 cups a day. You should eat less sugar. We've heard that before. And although they do say you should limit your saturated fats, the guidelines do not specifically say anything about eating less red meat. Well, that got the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network up in arms. But how much can we really trust any of this information about the health effects of what we eat? Christy Ashwanden is the lead science writer for the website 538, and she looked into that question for her latest story, You Can't Trust What You Read About Nutrition. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, great to have you. Let's start with this. How do nutritionists decide which foods are healthy for us and which foods aren't? What are they basing their decisions on?
So these are based on studies that look at groups of people. They sort of ask them what they've eaten, and then they look for correlations between this and whatever outcome they're interested in. So, for instance, there's been a lot of talk about this link between meat and cancer. And so in order to look at that, they'll take a group of people and ask them how much meat they usually eat, how often they eat it, when they eat it, how large are their servings. And then they compare the people who had cancer with those who didn't and see if they can find differences.
So they rely on self-reported food intake?
That's correct. Almost every nutrition study is based on self-reported food intake. And this was one of the main focuses of my story. What we did is we actually took a close look at how these studies are done by doing our own study. We hired a company that does food frequency questionnaires. This is the name of the tool that's most commonly used. There are several different versions, but basically what they do is they ask you, okay, potato chips, how often in the last 6 months did you eat them? When you ate them, how big a serving did you have? And so you're having to remember and report and you know, trying to do it with some sort of accuracy is really difficult.
Yeah, how can that be accurate? I can't remember what I ate last week.
Right. I mean, it can't. And that was sort of the point of our stunt, if you want to call it that, is that we tried very hard to produce data that we could really feel confident in just about ourselves, and we couldn't. I mean, we tried and failed to do that.
Are there better ways to figure out what people are eating?
There are some other better ways. For some types of nutrients, you could use biomarkers. You can use things like double-labeled water. But these are very expensive studies to do, and they're not available. Like, not every nutrient can be studied this way. There's no biomarker for, say, blueberries so that they can tell how much of this you're eating. But then the other problem is that you're really interested, for the most part, in outcomes that take a long time to develop. So you can't just take a group of, say, 100 people and bring them in and feed them specific foods for even a month and then expect to see any difference. You know, these are things that are going to accumulate over time. And so you really have to sort of rely on what people are doing in their real lives. It's just not feasible to do the kinds of studies that we would do with, say, drugs, where they do randomized controlled trials.
So whenever you see something like eating blueberries makes you remember things better, or I don't know, there are all sorts of things linking food to certain behaviors. All of that is based on these food questionnaires, these food frequency questionnaires?
They are. It's kind of, and when you start looking into it, it becomes pretty shocking. One of the things that we did is, so myself and a couple of colleagues took the food frequency questionnaire, but then we also recruited some readers of 538, and they also took the questionnaire, and then we asked them some totally unrelated questions, like, do you own a dog? Was your math score on the SAT higher than your verbal score? Did you think that the movie Crash deserved to win Best Picture, things like this. And using the same methods that are used in these things, we were able to find some really funny correlations. So, for instance, eating lots of egg rolls, we linked to dog ownership. Coffee, on the other hand, is linked to cat ownership, we found. One of my favorites is that potato chips were linked to a higher math SAT score. So, you know, the way that this
Eat up,
translated,
yeah.
If you were doing one of these normal nutrition studies that get a lot of media coverage, would be, you know, eating potato chips gives you better math scores. Well, we know that's ridiculous, right?
Yeah. So what about the federal government's nutrition guidelines released today? Are they based on data captured from these kinds of questionnaires?
They are. For the most part, they are. And I just want to point out that there's a really fundamental problem that begins before you even get to the data, and that is figuring out how to define what a healthy diet is. Some of the controversy around these new guidelines really get down to that question. The cancer groups are upset that there wasn't anything about meat, but I know I saw an interview with one member of the panel who said that they were really interested in chronic disease. Heart disease is the number one killer, and so they were, you know, going to give more weight to things that seemed related to that. An earlier draft actually had some things in there about sustainability. A lot of people are worried about obesity, and these are all different things, and it's really depending on how you're looking at the diets and what your outcome, you know, what kinds of things you're interested in the diet doing.
But just common sense and what we've been hearing over the years, and maybe we've been hearing wrong data that support these recommendations over the years, but common sense seems to say eat more fresh food, less processed food, maybe eat less red meat, more fruits and vegetables. Can anyone argue with that?
Not really. I mean, I think on a broad level basis, I mean, we know that more processed foods are probably not as healthy as less processed foods. We know that moderation is probably good, you know, no matter what foods you're eating. Part of the problem here is that we start promoting messages that are sort of at a level of detail or granularity that the tools that we're using can't provide. So things like, you know, eating blueberries helps your memory, that's a level of detail that we can't find from these questionnaires. And part of the problem is that you don't eat foods in isolation. So it's not like people who are eating blueberries you know, are eating everything else the same. If you eat a lot of blueberries, you may be inclined to eat a lot of other things. If you're eating a lot of one food, it's displacing something else that might be in your diet. So that's one reason I think that the new guidelines look at food patterns more so than individual foods. And I think that when you really start to look at the evidence, that's where we have better evidence, is in looking at patterns. So, for instance, the Mediterranean diet is one where there are certain characteristics of it, but no one's, for the most part, saying, you know, this particular food is magic. And when they start telling you that a particular food is magic, that's kind of a clue that you're getting off track and that it's probably going beyond the evidence.
Well, I want to believe that dark chocolate, red wine, those kinds of things are really good for me.
Right. Me too.
I really do.
Me too.
So maybe they are. If I can just believe.
Yeah. Definitely.
Kristi Ashwanden, lead science writer for the website 538. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think? Is there a diet that you strongly believe in? Are there foods you think are particularly healthy and ones you try to avoid, give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can reach out on Facebook or Twitter at KCRW PressPlay. Well, we do not need scientific studies to know that norovirus is bad for us. According to the CDC, it's one of the most common causes of foodborne illness in the United States. Chipotle is now facing a federal criminal investigation for an outbreak at a Simi Valley restaurant that sickened more than 100 customers and employees with norovirus. It's just one of several instances of Chipotle customers getting food poisoning in various states. So what's going on? Chipotle is supposed to be the healthy fast food. Joining me now to talk about this is Dan Klein, a contributor for The Motley Fool. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Well, let's talk about this federal investigation. What are they looking at?
Well, it's really just a request for information. It's not necessarily that there's something criminal going on. It's that they want all the paperwork, they want the rights to all the records, and they're going to look into whether anything knowingly happened at Chipotle. It could be bad luck, but it could also be an employee who was trying to sicken people. It could be an executive who ignored a test. I mean, you don't know, but this isn't a finding. It's really just the beginning of an investigation.
Well, it seems that Chipotle has had a lot of bad luck recently. They seem to be in the news quite a bit for foodborne illnesses.
Yeah, they're also dealing with another norovirus incident in Boston where about 120 people got sick. And more importantly, 53 people in 9 states were possibly infected with E. coli. Mm. And the problem with this here is Chipotle actually is a somewhat farm-to-table restaurant. They're not heavily processed fast food. They're serving pork that comes from a pig that maybe lived, you know, proverbially down the street. So they're more open to having these problems, the same way that if you go to the farmer's market and buy some food, you might come back and get sick. This is a teeny tiny number of people, but because its food isn't as processed as some of its rivals, Chipotle is much more susceptible to this kind of problem.
And yet we've heard from, you know, for a long time that it's because of the consolidation and the food processing that these foodborne illnesses have skyrocketed in recent years because they're able to spread more quickly throughout a system.
But when you look at something like a McDonald's, I mean, we've all seen the video where people put the cheeseburger by their desk and a year later it still looks like a cheeseburger. Chicken McNugget isn't going to get you sick if it's handled improperly. It's frozen, it's cooked, there's not much to it. The food that's being used at Chipotle, it's natural food. If you leave pork out too long, it gets people sick. If it's not cooked thoroughly, you won't kill some, you know, E. coli or some of these bacteria that can affect you. So by nature of being, you know, quote, better food or food with integrity, as Chipotle puts, it's going to have to put stricter processes in place, which the company says it's doing, but these are really relatively minor incidents. And the backlash is somewhat because Chipotle held itself up as sort of being better than its rivals. You know, people are eager to kick someone when they've held themselves up as better, and then they turn out not to be.
Because they are always touting the fact that they are the healthy alternative to fast food.
Yeah, absolutely. They're this snooty person with their nose up in the air saying they have food with integrity. And the reality is what they didn't say is because they do, you might get sick every now and then. You know, a heavily processed fish patty at Wendy's or Burger King is probably not going to be, you know, a danger of anything, whereas, you know, new chicken being cooked on a grill by someone making $11 an hour, you know, there's some issues with that.
Hmm. Well, what does this mean then for Chipotle's brand?
Well, it's bad in the short term. I mean, their stock has plummeted by about a third in 12 months, and it dropped 5% yesterday. But in the long run, Americans have been very forgiving of these types of scandals. I'm sure you remember the Tylenol scandal back in the 80s, where people actually died.
Yeah.
Sales rebounded in a matter of months. The same has been true when other fast food issues have come up, whether it's illnesses or in some cases it's, you know, health department inspections. So Chipotle is doing all the right things. They're stepping up enforcement. They're putting in new procedures. They closed many of these restaurants and did deep cleans. But the reality is people will come back after time passes. Chipotle has a good product. And I'll point out, I've been to Chipotle probably at least once a week since this happened, because statistically, you're talking a teeny tiny percentage, and I don't not go outside because of, you know, I might get hit by lightning. So this is a really small amount of people.
Yeah, except that norovirus is highly contagious, and it has swept through this area, at least, quite virulently over the last month or two. And it's scary to people when they go out to a restaurant and they trust that their food is safe, and they could come back with a horrible stomach illness.
Right, it is. And unfortunately, they haven't yet released sort of where the norovirus came from. Was it a person who was eating in one of those restaurants? Was it the food? With the case of the E. coli, they're pretty sure it's food-related. So this could be norovirus the same way you're susceptible to it on a train or a plane or in any public place. I trust Chipotle more than I do most companies to actually put procedures in place to keep people as safe as possible. But if you're going to cook fresh food, food that's not processed the way some things are, then people are going to get sick. It's going to happen. If you bake with eggs, someone's going to undercook an egg every now and then and get someone sick.
Well, are you safer eating then at a regular fast food restaurant than you are at, let's say, a fine dining restaurant or even in your home?
I think in some cases you probably are if you consider safer not getting sick in that moment. If you switch to a diet of all fast food and not cooking yourself, yeah, you're probably okay. But the reality is, in the long run, we all know that eating, chicken McNuggets and Big Macs for every meal is probably not very good for you. But yes, if you cook salmon at home, you might forget to wash your cutting board and get someone sick. Everyone needs to use proper procedures and be safe, but you can take it to extremes. If you only ate, packaged Hostess cupcakes, you wouldn't get salmonella, but you'd die of other things.
Die of happiness. Thank you very much. Daniel Klein, contributor to Motley Fool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we want to hear from you. Have you been burned by a bad burrito or some other restaurant menu item? Can you name the culprit? Tell us your tale of woe at 1-844-PRESSPLAY or comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, turning an eyesore into a city jewel, the designs for a new Pershing Square. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Now let's talk about plans to make over one of the ugliest public spaces in the country. I'm talking about Pershing Square. Just before Christmas, four finalists were announced in the Pershing Square Vision Competition. The goal is to transform the 5 acres across from the Biltmore downtown back into a place that people actually use and love. Frances Anderton is here now to talk about the plans. She's the host of DNA, Design and Architecture, here on KCRW. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
So four plans.
Well, four teams who don't yet have plans, but yes, four teams winnowed down from 10, that in turn was winnowed down from 80.
Okay.
And those teams are a mix of teams from outside and inside LA. Let's start with, we have SWA and Morphosis. Morphosis is an architecture firm. SWA is a landscape architecture firm, both based in downtown. Morphosis, most famously in LA at least, designed Caltrans.
The building downtown.
Near the police headquarters. Morphosis, loved and less loved, depending on what your perspective is on their kind of architecture, which is probably not one that you'd associate with soft, open, romantic spaces. They've got a tough aesthetic, but very, very interesting firm there on the list. We also have James Corner Field Operations with Frederick Fisher. Frederick Fisher, perhaps most famously in LA, was responsible for the Annenberg Beach House over redesign. He's done many other notable buildings. But James Corner Field Operations, anyone who's walked the High Line in New York, you will have walked on his work. Anyone who has walked Tongva Park in Santa Monica, you will have walked his work.
So he's the landscape architect.
Landscape architect, and basically these teams are landscape architecture led, but they come in with an architect because it's assumed there will be new buildings, and they also come in with people of many other disciplines. We have an architect from France, Agence Terre, very, very well established global firm. They've come in with a really lovely LA firm called Salt Landscape Architects, who are very much involved with some of the sort of street softening or street traffic calming kind of projects. And then we have a firm called Y Architecture. They've come in with a firm called Civitas. Y, they're known more for designing art galleries, frankly. They're helmed by a guy called Kulapat Yantrasast. He's been quite sort of a hot architect within the kind of art gallery design world. And he's quite an interesting person. And they've been brought in part because at the stage that they're at currently, which is they haven't come through with a design yet, they're posing questions. And why? The name of the firm is also kind of relevant. Why has been seen to be raising some really interesting questions about what that space could be.
And what are some of those questions?
The main question is how you're going to reconnect a very inaccessible space back into a downtown that has just been exploding. We've had 30,000 people move in since the last iteration of the park, which was 1994. The place is booming and Pershing Square sits there like a dead lump in the middle of it. And how are you going to reconnect that space to the city? And then the big question that comes as part and parcel of that is, what do you do with the parking structure? Pershing Square, which has gone through many iterations, perhaps it's most devastating back in the early 50s when the underneath was turned into a parking structure serving the suburbanization that was happening, mm-hmm. the freeways that were being built. The idea was to just get people into downtown for work and out onto the freeways, back into the suburbs to their homes. Pershing Square completely transformed at that stage. And since then, the struggle has been how to keep it as a kind of a public space when it sits atop a parking structure that has created all sorts of obstacles to entry. You've got the entry ramps and the ramps exiting the parking structure. Those in themselves have cut off corners. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's completely inaccessible for a pedestrian.
It's absolutely awful. And then in an effort to try and create some depth for soil and other elements of the park design, the park has wound up being raised since that parking structure was built. And a raised park just doesn't work. No. Everybody kind of intuitively understands that for a park to work, you need to be able to just walk into it off of the street. You can't be climbing up steps and not be able to see the park.
So how were these four chosen if they didn't have designs to present?
Well, there's been a long drawn out process of public outreach, and the public has certainly kind of expressed what its concerns are. And then there is a jury, and there's a jury of 10 civic folk, and those people have sat down for interviews with the team. So they've got a sense what though these teams might come up with or an approach they're going to take. We should say that the French team did actually come up with a design. They were the only one that did.
And what does it look like?
Well, what it looks like is if you imagine the square stripped essentially, and this is simplifying it, but into kind of three bands, the West Band will be a group of rather atmospheric gardens, a little like one might find at Huntington Gardens or something. Then the middle band essentially becomes open park, which is what probably a lot of people would like, is just simply somewhere to go and sit, hopefully shaded. Somewhat shaded. And then along the east band, they're proposing a shaded area that under which you would find cafes, you would find they're suggesting a co-working space. That's quite typical. A lot of the teams are thinking about how do we function now? What does contemporary society need from a public park?
I would
you
say
see that
less
coming out?
Work.
Yes. You just relax. No,
recreation.
Very interesting. No, it's interesting because over the holidays, I've spoken to a number of people about this park and a couple of people in the design world have said, just don't over-design it. The problem with this park last time around was it was so over-designed. Let's try and avoid that. Let's keep this light of touch. Let's mm-hmm. just make this somewhere where people can go and eat their lunch.
I'm talking to KCRW's Frances Anderton about the redesign of downtown's Pershing Square. Four teams have made it to the next phase of what's called the Pershing Square Vision Competition. And so, Frances, we talked about public spaces in one episode of our Making LA series, and the guests agreed that programming was more important than design when it comes to places like Pershing Square. What do you think about that?
Well, it's definitely an argument, and each of the teams has got somebody on board that will bring that piece to the proposal. I mean, it's still open to question, though. It seems that programming is really essential when the space has some problems. When you have a space that works really well, like the beach or the High Line, You don't need programming. Or Chris Burden's Urban Light at LACMA. There's certain spaces that become inherently so attractive to people that they don't need afternoon concerts. They don't need gatherings of screenings and this thing and the other thing, which has actually totally enlivened Grand Park to great success. But Grand Park has some problems in terms of being completely hemmed in by those courthouse buildings. So, and Pershing Square arguably has also had some challenges. Pershing Square has other challenges as well, which is sort of social. You know, Pershing Square has over much of its duration been, dare I say it, you know, it has been a magnet for homeless people. And this is an issue. And it's something that, you know, obviously there's the larger issue of how one alleviates the problem of homelessness. But then there's the issue of how public spaces make themselves appealing to all members of society. And that's a piece of this puzzle as well.
Well, you mentioned the homeless, and that's obviously a big, big problem in downtown, also elsewhere in LA. But are these proposals, are they tackling that?
Well, one thing that's a really important piece of this competition is it is not purely about design. They're asking them to do a bunch of other things that include revenue generation. Part of their interviews with the teams has involved hearing from them what ideas they might have for bringing revenue in that could pay for this park. There's seed money for the competition and there's some seed money for general expenses, but there is no money yet for this park. So the designers have to help think of ways in which to generate the money. The process itself is being used to generate interest and thereby funds.
Aha. Uh-huh. So us talking about it, they're hoping
will help generate interest. And I think it's an interesting process. The same is true of the LA River. That too is a process that by raising its visibility ultimately is intended to lead to more funds. They do want and need private investment. And a lot of the stimulus behind this whole project comes from the businesses in the neighborhood of Pershing Square who don't like the fact that the place is a dead, miserable lump in the middle of their town.
Well, given what you just said in terms of the tenuousness of the funding, what's going to happen? Is this going to happen or not?
Well, yes, it is going to happen because some of the seed money is going to pay the design teams to come up with a proposal. So each of those four is going to go off and work away at coming up with a design scheme. That is going to be presented in the springtime. They're looking at March or April. Then at that point, they will interview with the jury, but they also are going to, they say, have several days of public outreach where members of the public are invited to come in, view different design concepts and provide input. I've been to some previous public outreach. I went down to the farmers market in downtown one Sunday when they brought the previous iteration, the 10 concept boards were put up. It was kind of interesting because people were curious, but they didn't really understand the concept boards because they were kind of conceptual. You know, as even the Pershing Square Renew folks acknowledged, it's going to be easier for the public to understand what's going on when they see some actual schemes. But anyway, they do claim that they are going to heed the input of the public. They are going to have private assessments by the jury, this private jury, who will conduct private interviews. So ultimately, one will never really know what's been the kind of alchemical mix in terms of the team they choose. But that gives them 3 months of greater consciousness raising, I suppose, about the park that will produce funds to then move the project forward.
So perhaps we might see a new Pershing Square.
They're looking at 2020. And in fact, LA hosts the Olympics in 2024.
Aha, there's another incentive. Maybe they'll Indeed. Find that money after all.
Maybe they will.
Frances Anderton, host of DNA Design and Architecture, right here on KCRW. Thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
And if you could ask for one thing in a new Pershing Square, what would it be? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we may use your message later on in the show. Coming up, Making a Murderer is the binge watch of the moment. That show, plus The Jinx and the radio series Serial, have made true crime hot, but there are ethical concerns.
You're taking everything you see at face value, and you tend to believe what you're seeing. These are very persuasive forms of entertainment.
Crime and entertainment and journalism after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, true crime has long been a popular niche in books and TV, but now it's become a mainstream obsession thanks to new storytelling formats. The latest example is the 10-part Netflix series Making a Murderer. And before that, there was the HBO series The Jinx. Before that, the podcast Serial. All these works reinvestigate old murder cases, sometimes turning up new evidence. So this kind of journalism can be a public service, but it's also full of ethical pitfalls. Kelly McBride is Vice President for Academic Programs at the Poynter Institute. That's a journalism think tank, and she joins us now. Hi there.
Hey.
And also joining us, Stephanie Mary, staff writer for The Washington Post. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
So we're going to discuss this warning. We are going to have a few spoilers in this segment. So if you don't want to know what happened with Making a Murderer, turn the radio down. Okay, so Kelly, let's start with you. Serial, The Jinx, Making a Murderer, they all use storytelling techniques that aren't normal journalism or not the journalism you see practiced every day. Can you talk about that?
Sure. They're employing documentary techniques that have a combination of entertainment and journalistic purpose to them. And they do so in a way that's meant to entertain the audience as much as merely inform them. And I think the motivation behind this is we are all living in this ecosystem where we are inundated by information. And so storytellers are trying to use different techniques, more entertaining techniques, more engaging techniques, more compelling techniques to win the audience.
And do you have an ethical problem with that?
Not on the face of it. The only time I have an ethical problem is when a certain narrative device becomes the goal and the storyteller allows it to subvert the truth or distort the truth.
All right, so let's look at a clip from Making a Murderer, and here is a spoiler alert. This tells the story of Stephen Avery, his nephew Brendan Dassey. They are both now serving life sentences for murder, for the murder of a woman 10 years ago. The documentary makes the case they were framed. Here's a clip. This is Stephen Avery's lawyer, Jerry Butine, questioning a forensic expert during the trial.
You never found any DNA of Teresa Halbach's on any carpet in his house, did you?
No.
All the bathroom items, the floor, the vanity, the sink, mm-hmm. You tested all of those?
Correct.
None of them had Teresa Halbach's blood on it, did they?
No.
You tested many knives that were sent to you, right?
Yes.
I see at least seven just in the May 8th report, right?
Yes.
No DNA of Teresa Halbach's?
Correct.
Okay, so Kelly, it sounds like this film and the filmmakers are making the case that law enforcement framed Avery and his nephew, and it's definitely has a point of view, and that's also the hallmark of some of these new productions, that they take a point of view.
Right. So I don't think the point of view in and of itself is a problem, but in that clip that you just played, what you don't see is the big picture. You see this point of view at a very narrow point in time, whereas if we were treating that as straight journalism, we would put it in this broader context of here's all the evidence that they did have and here's all the evidence that they didn't have. Mm-hmm. And so the viewer or the audience member ends up on a ride, if you will, not really knowing where the story is going. And that's both the beauty and the bane of the form of storytelling.
And Stephanie Mary at the Washington Post, let me bring you in, because you had an article in the paper talking about the difference between Serial and Making a Murderer on that very point, that you make the point that Sarah Koenig in Serial makes it clear that she is investigating this and she doesn't know what the answer is, and that is the difference between the two.
Exactly. Yes, it's true. And also, I think that podcasts tend to be a little bit more confessional in tone, and so there's maybe a little bit more space for that. But throughout the episodes of Serial, Sarah Koenig was always pretty upfront about her feelings. Sometimes she felt like Adnan Syed was guilty, and sometimes she felt that he was probably innocent, and she waffled a lot. But we were always aware of those biases, whereas when you're watching Making a Murderer, there's no first-person narration, and that was the choice of the filmmakers, and that's a fine choice to make. But you're taking everything you see at face value, and you tend to believe what you're seeing. These are very persuasive forms of entertainment. So when you find out later that there were certain things that were withheld from you as the viewer, I don't know, you can feel a little bit duped by the storytelling, I think.
Well, let's play a clip of Sarah Koenig expressing her questions about this story that she spent many, many months, 15 months researching.
When Rabia first told me about Adnan's case, certainty, one way or the other, seemed so attainable. We just needed to get the right documents, spend enough time, talk to the right people, find his alibi. And now, more than a year later, I feel like shaking everyone by the shoulders, like an aggravated cop. Don't tell me Adnan's a nice guy. Don't tell me Jay was scared. Don't tell me who might have made some five-second phone call. Just tell me the facts, ma'am. Because we didn't have them 15 years ago, and we still don't have them now.
So you think that, Stephanie, that she's being more honest by admitting that she doesn't really know what the answer is?
I felt like she kind of won over the audience in that way. She seems like a very trustworthy guide because she's being upfront about her feelings about the case the whole time.
And Kelly, had they done that in Making a Murderer, do you think that there would be less questions about their techniques and about the project in its entirety?
No, I think there'd be different questions, but I don't think there would be fewer questions. With Making a Murderer, you have to infer the point of view. And so into that vacuum, the audience tends to assume the worst motives of the filmmakers. And that's always true. That's true of journalists as well, even when we're doing straightforward journalism. If we don't tell people what we were thinking or why we did stuff, people tend to think the worst of us.
Mm. Well, what about the sort of bigger question as to whether we should be finding and making entertainment out of these stories in the first place? Do you have thoughts on that?
Wow, that's such a hard question. Is it right to be entertained by I think stories are engaging and compelling and therefore entertaining, and they have been since the dawn of language for human beings. And so I'm not sure that that's really an ethical question. Mm-hmm. I think whether we should be exploiting their entertaining values, I think that's a tougher question, and I think we have to ask ourselves what our primary goal is, our journalistic purpose. And to the extent that our journalistic purpose is to shine a spotlight on something or to get to the bottom of something or to do explanatory journalism, I think those are all really good values that drive good storytelling. I mean, I don't want to do journalism that nobody reads, that nobody listens to. I don't want to be boring. I think that's bad, too. So it's complicated.
Right. It is really complicated. I mean, we're talking about this because on one level, it is entertaining. Kelly, what do you think about that question in terms of The Jinx? This was the series that looked into the multiple murders allegedly committed by Robert Durst and how that unfolded.
So the crazy thing about that was right as the series was coming to an end, Durst was arrested. And it made it seem like there was some sort of collusion or timing. Everything that I've read said that those two events had little to do with each other. But that one of all of these, I think, is the one where there are the most ethical questions about the storytellers and the devices that they used and whether they should have given evidence to the prosecutors, whether the stuff that they turned up was, whether it was right for them to withhold it during the entire process because it clearly implicated him.
Do you think that when you look at the phenomenon of journalists doing true crime stories, I mean, do you think that there needs to be some kind of, conversation amongst journalists about best practices ethically and how they should go about pursuing these stories, Stephanie?
I hope that all journalists in doing all types of work are having those conversations and thinking about those things. What you guys were talking about earlier about is it wrong that this is entertaining? And I think that all journalists want their stories to grab the reader or the listener or the viewer. And that's just a part of the job, kind of getting people's attention. So, you always want to be as fair as possible. And I think that the stakes are a lot higher with these true crime stories, especially since they really win people over and they extend beyond just the listening or the viewing. People walk away from this show and they go online and they sign a petition trying to free Stephen Avery, or they go into a Reddit group and try to get to the bottom of it, try to dig up old court documents. So I think that the stakes are a little bit higher, but I hope that that's a conversation that all journalists are having.
Right. And as far as the viewers are concerned, or the listeners or the readers, I mean, how are they supposed to digest these stories? Should they look at them with a jaundiced eye?
Well, that's actually, for me, I feel like that is something that Sarah Koenig and Serial sort of helped in a way, because she was really honest about the process and what she was revealing and what she wasn't revealing. I think that it made us a little bit savvier in terms of looking at what storytellers are withholding and what that withholding of facts does to our own biases as listeners. And I think people are really curious about how honest our storytellers are, and that's why they're going online and trying to get more details about a case.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
My pleasure.
That's Stephanie Mary, staff writer for The Washington Post, and Kelly McBride, vice president for academic programs at the Poynter Institute. And Warren Olney is here now.
Hello.
Hello there, to talk about To the Point.
We are going to be talking on To the Point about medical debt. There's a new survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation and the New York Times indicating that more and more people are looking at mountains of medical debt, despite efforts to enforce the Affordable Care Act. It really doesn't control a lot of the costs, including deductibles, insurance premiums, and various other things. And with out-of-pocket expenses and deductibles rising 7 times faster than wages, for example, it's getting pretty grim for a lot of people. The New York Times says that they've gotten more response to this article than they have for almost anything they've done lately.
Wow, really? And so these are all people who are insured you're talking about?
Yeah, it doesn't matter whether you have insurance or not.
Yeah, you're going into debt. All right, 1 o'clock, To the Point. Prepare to get angry. Thank you. Thank you, Warren. And coming up on this show, Shani Jardin is here to talk web stuff, including what she likes best at CES and why Facebook is getting the thumbs down in India and other developing countries. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and Shani Jardin is here, as she is most Thursdays, to talk about web stuff. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Co-editor of boingboing.net.
I prefer to think of myself as an internet princess, but
okay,
either or, you
wear many hats. Well, let's talk about the possibly groundbreaking, earth-shaking news that 140 characters may be no longer.
Yep. So in the beginning, Twitter was limited to 140 characters because most texting plans limited the number of characters in a text to somewhere around that. So the idea was that you would receive tweets on your phone as text messages. You could tweet things back via text to this application. It was very different than it is today. And there are some discussions happening around the internet, purported rumors that have been leaked in various places, that indicate that Twitter may be considering some big changes. One of them would be to expand the character limit, which is something that some of us get around already by screen capping our massive, epic, 100,000-word rants and then, you know, tweeting them at Donald Trump or the Pope or whoever we happen to be annoyed at
so
that day.
So screen capping meaning taking a picture of what you've written, and that counts as how many characters?
I think it's like 20. Why 20? I don't know. It's somewhere around that. Don't quote me.
It all seems a little arbitrary.
It is a little arbitrary. And while Jack Dorsey, the new head of Twitter, has neither confirmed nor denied that, it does sound like they're getting ready to make some sort of changes that, to be honest, it sounds like they're becoming a little more and more like Facebook. They introduced Twitter Moments recently. I'm just going to go ahead and call that a completely useless feature for me, something that I've learned how to skip over very quickly. But the idea is that it would show you a little snapshot of the zeitgeist in the same way that Facebook does. And it sounds like the expanded character limit is really more about having complete articles on Twitter. So in the same way that Facebook really wants to encourage you with instant articles to read the entire New York Times article right there in Facebook, Twitter would like you to go to Twitter and see the full press play transcript rather than going to kcrw.org. But the idea is that
keeps you... And they get money for that.
I don't know exactly how that will work, but the idea is that by keeping users in what some would refer to as a walled garden, an internet destination where, you know, everything you need is there. It's kind of like a casino, right?
Yeah. There are no clocks.
There are
no
clocks. You can get all the drink chips you want. You keep putting money in the slot machine and 140 pennies. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned Facebook, and let's jump to this news that India and some other countries, I think maybe 36 or so, developing countries, are saying no thanks to free Facebook.
Mark Zuckerberg announced a number of charity-ish initiatives in 2015, and one of them is an Internet for Poor People program called Free Basics. And the idea is that very poor people in developing nations like India, for instance, would be able to access Facebook, other basic low data count utilities like Wikipedia. It doesn't really take that much data to get a Wikipedia article down. They'd be able to access these basics, which Zuckerberg and his cronies determine are basic, without having to pay data fees to their carrier. So this would be, you know how sometimes if you go on a plane and there's Wi-Fi on the plane, you can get certain services for free, but you have to pay for the rest. It's like that, but on a much more basic scale.
And so why would they say no to that?
Well, who decides what's basic? And the Indian government and various regulatory bodies have problems with Zuckerberg over this for some reasons that are kind of specific to Indian politics. But the problem I have with it is many people around, billions of people around the world, could believe that Facebook is the internet. You know, Facebook is the thing that they get free. Facebook is the easiest thing to access. So something that's as much of a luxury and that is as much out of your economic reach as just being able to log on Facebook all the time, it's a big game changer when that's free. But who decides where these people can go, what they can do, what they can say? It's neither free nor basic in a way. Yeah. You know, if something like that is offered free by the company by the founder of the company that stands to benefit from it greatly, I think we have to look at what the real motivations are and what the world's poor masses actually need in order for us to bridge that digital divide. I don't know that Facebook, free Facebook, is the answer.
Well, what about what they're hawking at the Consumer Electronics Show?
Yes, that will
like
solve
a talking
everything.
Refrigerator.
My refrigerator talks to me every day. It says, close me, step away from the chocolate chip cookie dough.
Exactly.
You've had enough tamales.
Put it down.
But people who are out there braving the crowds in Las Vegas, I'm hearing drones. Drones are a big thing. Drones where you don't have to be a really good flyer of drones. Drones that can get off the ground, navigate, land themselves, where there's more assistive technology in the drone, basically so you don't crash it when you're a noob, when you're somebody who's new at it. Yes, smart home appliances, the Internet of Things, the Internet of Home Appliances.
Well, what do you think of that? We had a guy on yesterday who was talking about it, and he seemed pretty positive about it. But what do you think about it from a privacy standpoint?
There are so few standards and agreements on how these devices should talk to each other. There's very little consensus about where data should be stored or whether there should be common security protocols for how that data gets to how the data on your shower head about how many gallons you're using gets to what server where. There's a lot of ways that a lot of things could go wrong. But I think we're only going to be able to work those issues out as more of this technology proliferates. It's going to seem very weird for a while, just the same way that, you know, mobile technology did in the early 2000s. And there were all sorts of weird fears about that. They're popping up as well. To be honest, I'm a little too backwards and a little bit too much of a working class journalist to have a lot of this fancy stuff in my house right now.
When are we going to have a drone butler? That's what I want. My own private assistant / butler. Is a drone?
I do not have an answer to that. But
why? Interestingly, why don't you have an answer to that?
There are all sorts of... this is just basically clickbait. Everybody likes to talk about drones plus something else controversial. Zuckerberg is also talking about delivering internet by drones. Amazon seems to be teasing about the possibility of delivering by drones. I would like a burrito drone. I would like burritos to just fly into my house every day by drone and not have to interact with anyone.
What could go wrong?
Which brings me to another hot trend at CES this year, fitness wearables. So there are wearables that I'm reading about in the recaps and seeing in the photos that monitor blood pressure. There was one that was talked about that is for moms, pregnant moms-to-be, to help them with morning sickness, where when you're feeling barfy, it will make little pulses on your wrist, I guess on acupressure points. Mm. And there are others that are for people with diabetes. So drones, the Internet of Things in your home, smart wearables, virtual reality becoming cheap and becoming more usable, and also interesting accessories for gameplay, for immersive gameplay and VR play that really feel like they're made for that medium. So I'm enjoying CES at a distance. I think that's honestly the best way to do it.
Keep the drones at arm's length. Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Well, delivered by drone just moments ago is Jolie Myers.
Mm.
Hello.
Slightly less enticing than a burrito, I will say that. And speaking of that, Pershing Square.
Yeah, that's a nice segue.
It's getting a reboot, and we talked about that earlier on in the show. And our listeners had ideas for what they want to see in Pershing Square. And a lot of the ideas are about how to be active in this square. Randy Herrera says that he wants the part of the park to be turned into a skate park. And that would get a lot of people in there and moving. And Christian Beyer says that as long as the ice rink can still come back every year, I don't care what they do with it. So people want to be active in the park. If you have ideas for what you want to see, including burritos.
You can have a burrito square.
Yeah. Which is ring the whole thing with burrito vendors. That's my idea. And then the activity is just going back and forth from the burrito stands.
And I'll burn off those calories in no time. Jolie Myers, thank you very much. And Warren Olney, To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great burrito-filled afternoon, I hope, for you. I'll see you tomorrow.